From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Trump again tweeted his support for protesters in Iran. And last night, he responded to Kim Jong-un's New Year's Day statement that he has a nuclear button on his desk by tweeting that his, Trump's, nuclear button is bigger, more powerful, and unlike the North Korean dictators, it works. On Fox News this morning, Kellyanne Conway was asked if Trump believes the U.S. is close to war with North Korea.
The president has said many times nobody wants that. Of course not. Nobody wants that. But we've just seen so much over the past years of looking the other way. Look at what's happening in Iran.
The button boasting comes as congressional leaders are at the White House to continue tense negotiations to avoid a government shutdown later this month. As two Democrats were sworn into the Senate today, one replacing a Republican, narrowing the Republican majority to just one vote. It's Wednesday.
So
is that all? So let's bring in our political strategist this week, John Brabender, Republican strategist. Hi there, John.
Hello.
And Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Hi there, Jamal.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everyone. Mm-hmm. John, let me just start with you. As the president continues to taunt or respond to North Korea, which seems to be willing to at least meet with South Korea, as we know from earlier this week, should Trump allow the South to make some inroads there on the peninsula?
Well, look, I think that he's stuck in the middle here a little bit. On one hand, I think that the United States and most people would agree placated North Korea for too long, and it got us to the point where we are today, and that was a mistake. I think Trump has decided he's going to play hardball. I think that's probably the right thing to do. But I do worry about the rhetoric, because we're dealing with somebody who is culturally different than us, somebody who is trying to save face in many cases. And the more that we attack him in a way that embarrasses him publicly could lead to erratic behavior. And I see no logic in that. So I do think the president has to be careful of his rhetoric. But on the other hand, I think his tough approach is probably the right approach at this point where we are in the process.
Well, Jamal, you're the Democrat. What about the president's tweets supporting the protesters in Iran and his criticism of the Obama administration for not getting more involved in the 2009 Iranian protest? You know, Trump's been criticized for interfering in Iranian domestic politics. But Dennis Ross, who was in the Obama administration, on Monday said Trump was striking the right tone and the Obama administration made a mistake in not getting more involved in 2009. We're hoping to talk to Ross tomorrow, but your thoughts? He's saying Trump's on the right track.
I've been listening to some of the other experts who've been talking about this, and I heard someone yesterday who I thought made a lot of sense. One is that we don't really know who the people are yet who are in charge of the protests. So we should be supportive of the people, but we should also have a little distance just because we need to make sure we know who we are supporting. And point number two is if this we just have to also make sure that when you look at North Korea, that we're Senator Tim Kaine was talking about this today. The North Koreans are watching how we engage with Iran. And if we're trying to get a deal with the North Koreans, but we're looking at holding back on sanctions or supporting the overthrow of a regime in Iran, the North Koreans will pay attention to that. So these things are linked. And I think it's very tough for us to just wade in here with tweets about sizes of buttons and not have someone who is really deftly paying attention to all these details manage this crisis.
Well, John, right about that, I just want to follow up because, yes, North Korea is watching and saying, hey, look, if you wreck the deal with Iran, why should we make one with you? But Trump's got just 2 weeks to decide whether to continue to lift the sanctions in Iran. That was part of the nuclear deal. He says he hates the deal. But if he doesn't continue to lift the sanctions, the Iranian people he's trying to speak to through Twitter will hate him.
Well, it is complicated, especially if you look at sort of the uprising in Iran is different than the last time this happened. Last time it was pretty much maintained in just the cities. This time it's actually rural as well. So it's a completely different group of people and frankly should give Americans much more hope that it'll have some long-term effects. With that said, as you know, the president has to decide in about 2 weeks whether he's going to let go some of these sanctions based upon are the Iranians following what we did sign. I agree with the president. It was a horrible deal for America, but it's a signed deal, and we have to show that we are trusted characters when it comes to deals that we have signed. What I think Iran would probably love is for the president to all of a sudden make the leaders in Iran the victim by putting punishing problems, you know, restoring these problems. And instead, I think the president should not do it for penal reasons unless the administration truly believes that they are not following the agreement that Iran signed. And then I think they have no choice.
Yeah.
So,
you know, Robin and Meghna, I guess there's one other point that we can't get away from this. The president has been sending out all these tweets since New Year's Day that seem to steadily be ratcheting up the rhetoric and becoming more inflammatory, not just about Iran, but then also Pakistan, then also about Huma Abedin and whether or not she should go to jail, Hillary Clinton's former assistant. I think we've got to wonder, what is it that is troubling Donald Trump so much that he is willing to throw the world into this kind of disarray in order to distract us from the thing that he's trying to hide?
Okay, well, perhaps, and who knows? I'm not inside the president's head, but perhaps, I mean, maybe there we have an indication about this new book that's coming out next week. I mean, again, I don't know how much stock to put in this, but it's really fascinating because Michael Wolff, he has this new book coming out next week, Fire and Fury Inside the Trump Presidency. I mean, he was practically in residence at the White House for a year, in part invited by the president, spoke to 200 people, including the president and members of his inner circle. It's a very anticipated book. New York Magazine has an excerpt of it, which I just went through, and it's quite something. Now, there's a point here where he says Steve Bannon called Paul Manafort and Donald Trump Jr. perhaps treasonous or unpatriotic for meeting with the Russians inside a Trump Tower. And Steve Bannon says they should have called the FBI. I mean, your thoughts, John?
Well, look, I mean, I know a lot of these people pretty well. And if you know Steve Bannon, you understand that he sees things very much black and white. He's a very strong former naval officer. And I think that he is talking from the heart when he sees it this way. I don't happen to agree with him in the sense that I think you had a lot of amateurs, you know, making poor decisions during the administration with some of the meetings they had. But I don't think that to call it treasonous, I think, is sort of ridiculous. But again, let's be honest, too. These are people that Steve is not presently happy with at the moment. It's no surprise that he and Jared did not always get along. And I don't think he probably had the closest relationship with Manafort. In fact, he basically came in and took Manafort's job. And so I think Steve is being honest in what he's saying, but I think that there's other motivations in there. And I think we've got to be very, very careful to use words like treasonous unless we really understand the motivations and the rationale and what really happened.
Well, but Jamal, that was your point, though, that I think, because you have tweeted that the president's inflammatory tweets, you know, could be an effort to deflect from the Russia investigation.
Here's what we know. What we know is that the Russians have tried to influence the American election. We know that the Russians tried to get to the Trump family. We know the Trump family met with the Russians. We know that Don Jr. was communicating with WikiLeaks, which our intelligence officials seem to think was a cutout of the Russians. We know that the Trump people, when they're asked questions about their meetings with the Russians, they seem to have this great case of amnesia until they're found out, and then they have to revise their statements. I think all of these things say to us there's something here about Russia that we do not understand. And when you have someone inside of the Trump orbit that close to Steve Bannon who says this may be treasonous, it is up to us to listen. And we also know the president of the United States said to the Russian foreign minister, I fired the FBI director to get the heat off on Russia. I mean, I'm not, at some point,
yeah,
but, we have to stop. We have to stop wondering what's going on here and pay attention to what it is we're discovering.
There's other parts of this in the equation that you did mention. One other thing we know is that somebody, maybe the Russians, leaked emails where Hillary Clinton's campaign was conspiring with the Democratic National Committee against Bernie Sanders' campaign. And you can't blame that on the Russians for opposing it.
So we're going to chase.
You can blame that on Hillary Clinton. And let me ask you this. Let's go back to something that President Obama did that we all know did. He got secretly caught on tape, pulling aside the Russians and saying, oh, by the way, after the election, I can be more flexible on negotiating missiles with you.
You're
right?
Trying to deflect from the case at hand.
The case at hand
is about the current president, whether or not he has been in bed with the Russians.
If you're going to call what happened in the Trump world treasonous, I don't know what you call Barack Obama.
I didn't call it anything.
But if I could just jump in here, I mean, for the example of Obama, he was still president after the election until January and the inauguration. And the Trump side of things, he was not yet officially president of the United States. That's a pretty big consequential difference. Well,
and also, there's one other point. There's one other point here. That Barack Obama, President Barack Obama was not trying to hide this from his staff and from his lawyers, as it appears that Donald Trump was doing when he had his meeting on Air Force One and refused to let the White House lawyer on the phone for an hour, according to Steve Bannon's recount in this book.
So I'm guessing, I'm not sure
I'm comfortable with us leaving it out there that somehow, because Barack Obama was in power, that he says, look, here's what I'm going to do secretly until after the election, that somehow that gives him a pass. I could make the argument that in some cases that's even worse. Well, and so I just think that, you know, on all these areas, this has become so politicized on both parts of the aisle that you can take any of these behaviors and you can take it to the extreme. And what we really don't know is what happened. And until we do know that, until the FBI comes out and lets us know, I don't know how we can make all these arguments. And
the National Security Advisor has pled guilty to a crime.
And the Russians are thrilled.
And we're out of time. We know that too. Yeah.
John Pravender, Republican strategist, Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Enjoy you both. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Nineteenth-century French composer Georges Bizet is probably best known for this. Carmen, one of the most popular operas of all time, groundbreaking in 1875. But tragically, 3 months later, Bizet was dead. Then, about 60 years later, an astonishing discovery among the Bizet family possessions. Bizet's Symphony in C, which the youthful Bizet probably wrote for homework in music school. It caused a sensation when it premiered in 1935. And to classical music writer Fran Hopfner, it smells just like teen spirit. Fran writes colorfully about classical music for The All. She joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
So you're speculating, what, he was about 17 when he wrote this?
About 17 years old, and it really does sound like it to me.
Yeah, teenage stuff. Well, you write, as Mozart changed classical music forever, Bizet, with this Symphony in C, changed romantic music forever. Explain.
Well, at this point in time, romantic music was sort of drifting into like a more programmatic or narrative-based storytelling, and I think Bizet sort of takes the elements that made Mozart and Beethoven so successful, those formulas, those variations on melody, and brings just a lot more heart to them and a lot more story.
Well, and he writes it 60 years before it, you know, comes onto the scene.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a little more of the opening movement, Allegro Vivo. And as we do, what are you hearing? Frenzy.
Yeah, this really frantic kind of joy. I really do think he's sort of trying to emulate Beethoven with this. This is a little bit like when you're starting to learn an art and you discover all your favorites, and then the early art you make sounds a lot like what they did because that's what you know.
Well, it's also, as you say, I mean, we have to put ourselves in the time. This is like a top 40 hit. It's catchy. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I love to just have this symphony on. I think it's so sweet and funny.
Yeah. Well, you also say it may be okay that it is just that, you know, that it's kind of like, well, it makes you feel young again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Bizet also came to learn that he really didn't like writing symphonies that much. They weren't really for him. But I love that this is just an effort, and yeah, it's just a nice piece of music.
Okay, and we think that it's homework because the Paris Conservatory waived its age requirement and let him in at the age of 9. He wrote this at 17, and it got buried away. You say he doesn't, you know, didn't think he was one to write symphonies. Do you think he just shelved it?
Yeah, I think he sort of hid it away and he thought that maybe later in his career he would borrow something from it or come back to it, but that wasn't the case.
Yeah. Let's go to the second movement, the Adagio. A lot of musical suspense, which leads up to a mysterious oboe solo. Let's listen. But what are you hearing here that says teen music?
Well, I love that it's romantic and maybe a little seductive, but I think there's kind of a wall up. It's a little bit like performatively romantic, as if he hasn't really experienced the intense emotions he's trying to portray in the symphony.
He's 17.
Yeah.
The choreographer George Balanchine created one of his greatest duets with this music for the ballerinas who were his muses. But now we go to the third movement, Allegro Vivace. Let's listen. You say it's like turning up the radio in your car. Talk about some of the melodies we're hearing.
We're hearing kind of a stately dance form, and I think this movement, too, is a callback to the work of Mozart and to Beethoven. It has that really jovial, stately feel to it, and I really like it. It's really easily hummable. It's repetitive in a way that feels familiar.
And then at 2:29, enter the cellos.
Well, the cellos here just pick up a lot of energy, and they really support the orchestra in tandem with the woodwinds.
Well, the fourth movement is also Allegro Vivace,
mm-hmm.
but this is the one you call completely effing insane. We mentioned that you're very colorfully about classical music. But why? Let's listen. Oh, that's why. They're off to the races.
Yeah.
Was it thought that orchestras could play this? I mean, it was never performed for him.
It's hard to say. I know that the orchestra and the singers complained a lot about Carmen being too difficult, so it's possible this also might have been on the more difficult side, which is why it's why I love it. It almost, when you listen to it, it sounds like bragging that the melody is so fast, and he's trying to prove that not only can he write something that fast, but that musicians can actually play.
Right.
It's a very teenage thing to do.
Well, you know, now that I think about it, that's kind of sad. Did he ever hear this performed? He didn't, did he?
No, he never heard this performed.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah.
By the way, Bizet was not the only 17-year-old to do impressive things. We know that. But Felix Mendelssohn, for instance, his overture to his Midsummer Night's Dream. Let's listen to a little of that. This is 25 years before Bizet's Symphony in C.
This is such a gorgeous piece of music.
But it reminds us these are rock stars.
Yeah.
And you're taking that further to talk about them as teens. What is the image that you close with of Bizet?
That he's like doing skateboard tricks, essentially, with this symphony. He's just kind of showing off and trying to, impress people. I think that's what ultimately this symphony is trying to prove himself. There's a precociousness to it.
Well, but when we think, his life almost wasn't a big success. Carmen almost didn't get premiered. People thought it was too scandalous, you know, an amoral gypsy who worked in a cigarette factory with a, you know, some other kind of sad people. So that almost didn't get produced. He dies 3 months later, and we almost didn't find the symphony.
Yeah, it's been sort of a quiet miracle that his work has managed to balloon the way it has, especially in the 20th century. I mean, even the reaction to Carmen from the audience at the time was pretty lukewarm, which I think almost speaks to the strength of his work. You kind of have to let it sit with you and you have to think about it. And this symphony was also something that I listened to over and over and over again until I kind of got it.
Yeah. Bizet apparently was asked to write something about good ultimately triumphing. He came up with the story of Carmen, the underclass. It was considered both groundbreaking realism, but the critics called it vulgar. Singers horrified they had to smoke and act and not just stand there and sing. And yet, wow, has it withstood the test of time.
Everyone knows it now. Yeah. And there's nothing really that scandalous about it.
Yeah. And do people know Symphony in C? We've been listening to a Leonard Bernstein recording, which is kind of an endorsement right there.
Yeah, I don't know that a lot of people do know the Symphony in C. I know it was new to me. I was looking just to see what else Bizet had in his catalog, because while I love Carmen, I don't tend to write about opera too often.
Yeah.
So it was just, by chance that I happened upon it and that I have come to love it so much.
Well, ballet fans have long known the piece, but if you don't, Fran Hopfner suggests that you give it a listen. So we're going to go out on a little more of 17-year-old Bizet's work, so full of life and musical promise. Fran Hopfner writes the classical music column for The All. Fran, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The first day recreational marijuana was legal in California, we spoke to one of the 100 legal business owners. There were lines outside his door. Stock prices of related companies have been soaring all week. The illegal California industry was worth about $13 billion. The legal industry is expected to be worth around $7 billion. But in two of the state's big cities, Los Angeles and San Francisco, stores haven't opened or started selling yet because there are more than 1,000 license applications still pending. Let's check in with Maggie Lake. She hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Robin.
So first of all, did the sales hit expectations this week?
I think so. I mean, this is the modern-day gold rush, right? And as you mentioned, L.A. and San Francisco, not even online. Listen, we're going to have to wait a little bit to get meaningful numbers. But just as you said, my colleagues and our reporters who are around, scouring around, mm-hmm. lines around the block, hundreds lined up in store owners talking about 50, 60% increase in sales. So it seems like it's a success.
Well, what about the financing? Marijuana is still illegal on a federal level. Entrepreneurs can't open bank accounts. Most banks don't want to do businesses with something that's illegal on a federal level. So first, where are they getting the money and how's that being channeled?
Yeah, it's from the private sector right now. And I have to tell you, this is probably the number one hurdle when you're talking about pot as a business, right? Everybody sees all this opportunity. But these startups, dispensaries, growers, whoever they are in every line of it, cannot use the traditional banking system. And by the way, banks would probably love to get a piece of this business too. Mm. But they are prevented because it's against the law federally. Any transaction is considered money laundering. And it's not just about getting the finance. It's also about depositing the money. So at the moment, being filled by private investors, a lot easier when you're talking about financing. It's a lot harder when you're talking about the deposit side. So this is a big issue.
Well, yeah. And there has been a suggestion by California's treasurer to open a public bank. Not just, so people have some place to put their money, but how do you pay taxes on it?
Yeah, listen, I mean, I think that they want to because the whole point of making this legal is to get it out of the shadows, right, and be able to track it, to be able to collect the taxes on it and make sure they're not sort of, you know, underreporting. The problem is I spoke to someone, Joshua Latterman, today. He's the founder and CEO of the National Association of Cannabis Businesses, first one, sort of an industry group. And he feels like it's a good idea what California is trying to do with this clearinghouse, but that the tier one banks are not going to get on board because of the federal rules. Maybe they'll get some smaller banks, regional, some credit unions. That's not going to eventually solve. Listen, it's better than nothing. But his group is working on getting basically auditing standards, record of compliance to try to bring some of those reluctant government officials and those banks on board. So it's a start, but it's not the answer to the problem.
Well, and the report that just came out this week about what do we do from the state recommended that maybe the state hired armored car services to pick up tax payments from businesses because it's going to be bags of cash. But meanwhile, speaking of deliveries, we're seeing another headline that there could soon be an Uber for marijuana delivery.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more skeptical on this part. Listen, they haven't even figured out the basics, right? They're sort of decided it was legal, but now they're trying to fill in all the little laws. Two issues that they face. They're still working on legality and licensing. I think they're only going to give out a certain amount of licenses. They're going to limit times. It's not going to be the Uber immediately. The other issue is safety. Everybody who's ever worked as a delivery person knows that's an issue in any industry, but you're talking about not burgers, much more lucrative items being delivered. So they're going to have to work that out as well.
And figure out how do they prove they're not selling to minors, stuff like that. Maggie Lake, host CNN Money with Maggie Lake.
Fascinating stuff.
It is. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Most doctors advise their patients to get regularly screened for cancers after a certain age or if they have a family history of those cancers. Now, those screenings may reduce the number of deaths from diseases like prostate and breast cancer, but there's some evidence that widespread screening could also lead to overdiagnosis and sometimes harmful treatment for cancers that may pose little or no risk. And that's skewing our understanding of risk factors, according to findings published this week in the journal Annals of Internal Medicine. Sharon Begley is senior science writer for our partners at STAT. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, what are these cancer experts saying about we're not understanding risk factors correctly because we overscreen? Tell me about that.
Exactly. So there are some cancers where if you develop them, unfortunately, eventually or sometimes sooner than eventually, you will experience symptoms. You will get sick and unfortunately, sometimes you will also die. Those cancers include ovarian, brain cancers, and a number of others. But there are other cancers where if you don't look for them, you can't tell that you have the cancer because they do not cause symptoms, and in about half of the cases, they would never threaten your health, let alone your life. So these are what the experts call scrutiny-dependent cancers. The harder you look for them, the more you find, and if you don't look for them, you don't find them because they are basically harmless. And those include prostate, breast, and thyroid cancers. And the fact that these are, again, scrutiny-dependent cancers has messed up our understanding of what increases our risk of developing them.
Okay, so in your STAT article, you give the example of thyroid cancers, where women are three times more likely than men to be diagnosed, but that being a woman may not actually be an accurate risk factor?
Exactly. Thyroid cancers cause almost no symptoms except in a few very rare cases. Most people who develop thyroid cancer will die with thyroid cancer rather than from thyroid cancer. But if you get screened for it, which is usually through imaging or sometimes through palpation, the doctor just feels your neck and your throat, you are more likely to be diagnosed with it because it can be found. It turns out that women are better connected to the healthcare system than men are. Therefore, women are about three times more likely to be diagnosed with it. But the two sexes die of the disease at almost identical rates. So that just does not compute. So what seems to be happening is that women see their doctors more. They're more likely to be checked for thyroid cancer. Lo and behold, they're told that they have it. If men were screened for thyroid cancer at the same rate as women, sex as a risk factor for this cancer would almost certainly disappear. And the take-home message for, you know, just regular people here is that if you are a woman, you don't have to be, you know, really, really afraid that you are three times more likely than your male friends to get this cancer.
We are talking about cancers, though, and for so long, the thinking has been frequent screening, early detection, early intervention, and then increasing survival rates. That's a very powerful line of thinking in medicine that has saved a lot of lives. So are we talking about changing that?
Well, it's a very hard idea to give up because cancer is such a scary thing. It doesn't seem like there's much that we can do about it. So we seize on the idea of early detection as one of the only ways that we can save our lives, basically. But we have seen a sea change in that thinking in the medical community and in the scientific community over the last few years. You see that in professional groups like the American Cancer Society dialing back their recommendations for who should get screened, how often, and starting at what age. And the reason is, let me, again, it's simpler to understand with an example. Let's do prostate cancer. If 1,000 men get PSA screening, that's the blood test, for 10 years, only one of those men will avoid death from prostate cancer. 60 or more of them will experience serious complications like incontinence and sexual impotence. So 1,000 men screened every year for 10 years, you have saved only one from dying of this disease.
So then what are these cancer experts saying about what we need to do in order to get a more accurate sense of what the actual risk factors are?
So the experts are saying that rather than focus on risk factors for developing cancers, we should focus on the risk factors for dying of cancer. So again, in the case of thyroid, men and women die at the same rate. So clearly, gender, sex is not a risk factor for dying of thyroid cancer. Let's look at what really might predict that. Because although it's horrible to be diagnosed with cancer, it's even worse to die from it. And that's what we should be focusing on, say the experts, and then we will not be misled by these, you know, red herrings that we are finding more just because we are looking for it in some groups more than in others.
Well, Sharon Begley is a senior science writer for STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you so much, Sharon.
Thank you.
Well, if you've traveled on quiet county roads in rural America, you've probably seen old, weathered, and abandoned homes. But the people of Smith Center, Kansas, have made a point of saving one such home on the range. That's because it is the home on the range. CJ Genevieve from member station KCUR has our story.
Smith Center is pretty much the geographic center of America. It's an hour from the nearest interstate, and maybe a couple thousand people live here. L. Dean Holtis knows what outsiders might think of a place like this.
Whoa, we thought this was just a little hole in the ground. No, we're big time. We're big time here in Smith County and Smith Center.
He's got an international historic site.
A home on the range cabin.
As in?
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer.
L. Dean Holtis will tell you he's 84 years old, that he's lived here in Smith Center all his life. He wears a dark cowboy hat and a leather vest. Holtis is chief visionary, cheerleader, and tour guide for the Home on the Range cabin.
Well, we've got tour buses to make it.
About 20 miles down the official Home on the Range highway are a dozen rugged acres of land that belonged to Holtis's aunt and uncle. Way back in the 1870s, a troubled doctor named Brewster Higley holed up in what was basically a shack for some peace and quiet.
I think we can all get in.
Brewster Higley wrote a poem which a local guy named Dan Kelly set to music. By the 1930s, it was the number one song in America. But a couple in Arizona claimed they'd written the song and sued music publishers and broadcasters for copyright infringement. So music publishers sent an investigator out west to trace the song's origins back through the cattle drives to Brewster Higley's homestead near Smith Center.
Then in 1947, the Kansas legislature made it the state song of Kansas. That created a new interest.
A few years ago, people in Smith Center restored the structure and cleared walking paths around the property. They have more big ideas for the place because they know a home on the range was a big deal. Filmmaker Ken Spurgeon discovered that when he started interviewing musicians about the song.
Hearing them tell me that they would play the song in Argentina and people knew it when they didn't know any other American song, or China. I had a person from Russia come up and tell me they heard it in a Russian bar.
And the skies are not cloudy all day.
Neil Young, and countless other musicians have covered the song. People in Smith Center know they're lucky to have a legitimate tourist attraction, but it still needs some work. They're raising money and support by hosting more events, like a celebration where it seemed half the town showed up for a barbecue dinner.
It really takes a community to come together and say, this is something special we have. You should come see it.
Kim Coleman was born and raised in Smith Center, married her junior high sweetheart, and is raising her kids here. She's been out to the Home on the Range cabin ever since she was little, on school field trips and for other events.
Set out in a pasture under the cloudless sky and listen. You hear birds chirping. You hear the wind moving. You hear the rustle of animals. During the evening hours, when the stars are out, when there's so many stars you can't count them, it's amazement.
It's also something else.
The city's wonderful. I've been there. It's great. But this is home.
That idea is what made Brewster Higley's poem a worldwide hit. Because songs about home are universal. For Here and Now, I'm CJ Janovy reporting from Smith Center, Kansas.
A 61-year-old professor in Turkey recently said farewell to his students at Bilgi University and moved to Brussels and a new teaching position. Now, that's just one story from a growing brain drain in Turkey. Intellectuals are leaving Turkey because many of them are worried about the direction the country has taken under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. That includes his brutal crackdown on dissent after a failed coup against his government in 2016 and the subsequent arrest of many thousands. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from Istanbul. And Mark, first of all, tell us about this professor. Who is he and why has he said he's leaving Turkey?
Well, his name is Bülent Somay, Magna, and he is a professor of cultural studies. He was a professor of cultural studies here in Istanbul at the Bilgi University, one of the top universities. And he's gone to Belgium because he says that academics don't feel safe anymore in today's Turkey. He said that they are worried about students recording their lectures and releasing excerpts to the pro-government media and labeling them as somehow insulting the president or enemies of the state. He is actually one of 1,128 academics who signed a petition back in January 2016 calling on the Turkish government to cease armed conflict against the PKK Kurdish militant group here in Turkey that's been going on for some time. And the Turkish president reacted furiously to that petition. He called them so-called intellectuals. He said they had engaged in treason. A pro-government mafia boss said he would bathe in the blood of those academics. And they have all been fired from the universities, and many of them have been charged with terrorism propaganda. So that's just one story among many of the sort of clampdown on intellectuals and academics, and it tells the story of a much greater clampdown on people who challenge the government here, whether they are journalists, intellectuals, leftists, secularists, which has picked up really since the failed coup a year and a half ago, and that is accounting for this quite steady brain drain now, which we're seeing from Turkey.
So this professor actually spoke with you. We have some tape. Let's listen to what he told you.
We're not even feeling safe during lectures anymore. They just record what you say in class, and then you see them on pro-government media. You write something, and then you start getting threats and insults.
So echoing what you were just telling us, Mark, what effect is this brain drain having on Turkey?
There are no national statistics here in Turkey on the migration exodus, but we, in the course of our reporting, collected some examples. So in the space of the last 2 years, since that peace petition that I was telling you about, 698 Turkish academics have applied to a US-based organization called Scholars at Risk to be moved abroad because they feel in danger. The British Home Office has told us, for example, that 17,000 more Turks have gone to Britain in the last last 5 years. 7,000 Turks have moved to Germany in the last 5 years, 5,000 to France. So what you're seeing is a steady exodus of those who are opposed to the direction that Turkey is taking. And it is the secular, it is the intellectual, it is the well-to-do who are applying for so-called golden visas, which basically give them nationality or residency in countries like Greece and Portugal and Spain. Jewish citizens here, Turks of Jewish descent, are trying to get out to apply for nationality to Portugal and Spain. Over 4,500 of the 17,000 Turkish Jews have done that. So you are seeing a sort of steady an exodus, I suppose, of those who feel that their future is no longer in Turkey. And I suppose in years to come, Turkey could count the cost, really, of that steady demographic change.
Now, while this all sounds more than troublesome, to say the least, I wonder what, I mean, Turks feel about this, because the country seems, it feels very divided. I imagine that the many supporters of President Erdogan don't see a problem with this exodus.
You're absolutely right, Megno, and he has got huge support still in this country. Half the country absolutely supports him. They're behind his reforms to give a voice to the more conservative side of the country, to reform the economy, to expand the middle class. He has made the country more religious, and the half of the country that is more conservative and pious are very much behind him. But the other half of the country, the secular side, the ones who feel that Turkey has lost its anchoring to Europe and the West, and relations with the US particularly very bad at the moment, are absolutely, they revile him. So, you know, it is split in two, this country. You either revere or revile him. And those who support him, they don't care about those who are leaving. They say that they are traitors, they are opposed to Turkey's progress. And I suppose to some extent there's a kind of, I mean, pundit I spoke to said that this is some kind of social engineering of Turkey. It is making the country more conservative, more religious, more molded in the image of President Erdogan. And in decades to come, that is perhaps the Turkey that is going to emerge from this time.
That's the BBC's Mark Lowen speaking to us from Istanbul. Mark, thank you so much.
Pleasure, Meghna.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.